the magic of music. For me, music has always been a pleasure, a protector, and my passion. The words my favorite artists sang gave me strength and courage and inspiration and motivation to keep going, to keep living, and to believe something better was around the corner. Music gave me hope when I felt hopeless, love when I felt unloved, a reason to embrace life when I was dying inside. If a song moved me, then I felt I was alive for a reason. Later, I came to the truth of knowing these blessings were all gifts from the Lord. Music was simply the conduit for them to reach my heart. In my new faith, I completely immersed myself in Christian music. My Walkman and headphones became permanently attached to my body. For you young ones, a Walkman was a portable cassette tape player. If you aren't sure what a cassette is, ask your favorite search engine. These devices were spiritual and emotional lifelines for me. Because of my obsession with contemporary Christian music, known to the insiders as CCM, I know everything about my genre of choice. I'm a Christian music nerd, geek, and aficionado. I know way too much about the history, the artists, and the industry. In a strange way, I had a neighbor named Chris to thank for that. Chris lived just down the street from us. He was a little older than me, closer to my brother's age, and was a strong Christian. And, key to the story, I thought this guy was the coolest ever. He was always super nice to me, which made him even cooler. One day, Chris invited me over. His room had all these incredible concert posters on the walls. I was instantly impressed and amazed. The one that most captured my attention was for U2's The Unforgettable Fire. Chris encouraged me to sit still, to fully focus on and truly listen to a song, to take in all the nuances and the melody and the lyrics, the lows, the mids, the highs, and the dynamics of the track. He inspired me to tune out everything else and zero in on what the artist was trying to say to me. As Chris popped in U2's Fire cassette and hit the play button, I sat mesmerized and soaked in every tune. As the last track started, Bono began to sing the ethereal, poignant song MLK. If you've never heard of it, find it and listen. When the track ended, I asked him to play it again and again. I was mystified. I couldn't get enough. This haunting track had innocence, passion, simplicity. There was something special about it. Many nights I would lie in bed and sing along with MLK over and over. In fact, still today I find myself sometimes lying down with one of my kids for a few minutes at bedtime singing that song. Music had an effect on me like none other. It could make me forget about anything. If I knew Dad was going to discipline me, I would sing until he walked in. Then I would sing afterward. My catalog of cassettes was literally the soundtrack of my life. And now I was starting to connect the spirit in me to that same spirit in music. To this day, when I put on music, I have to listen and not just hear it. If I want to play you a song and you start talking, I'm the guy who will hit stop and start it over because I want your full attention on what is coming out of the speakers, not your mouth, mine, or anyone else's. The only other artist I have ever met who is as militant as me about that is Kirk Franklin. I know because once he was playing me a song and I started talking. He hit stop, waited on me to finish, and then started the song over. I've always gotten frustrated when people won't give a song the attention I think it deserves. In high school, after I started driving, I'd often pull over at a quiet spot on the way to drop my date off. She probably thought that was the cue to start kissing, but no. Instead, I'd turn up my latest musical infatuation on the car stereo, lay the seat back a bit, close my eyes, and tune in. If she would cooperate and listen the way I did, and not talk to me but tune in with me, that was one way I knew if our relationship could go anywhere. The first Christian music cassette I ever had was by Amy Grant, but the very first one that I saved up my own money to purchase was Petra's More Power to You. The band's name came from the Greek word meaning stone or rock. They were the most popular Christian rock band for many years. While a lot of people in the church in that era debated the merging of Christian lyrics and rock music, for me, it was a godsend to hear melodies like the ones I heard on the radio coupled with words I knew came from my Bible. One particular day, Dad saw that I hadn't cleaned my room after he had told me to do it by the time he came home. I had also left out my Jambox, a cassette player with my beloved, hard-earned Petra tape still in it. He walked into my room and asked, "Is that your new tape and the player you left out?" Scared, I nodded. He took the cassette out of the machine and snapped it in half. The Jambox was one of those super large models with speakers that could be detached for better positioning. Let's just say that after Dad was done with it, you could put the speakers anywhere you wanted, but they would no longer work. He completely destroyed that machine. But the good news was that it wasn't long until I had another copy of More Power to You, and because Stephen was about to go away to college, he gave me his Jambox. I just made sure from that point on I kept it all out of Dad's sight. To be eligible to go on the church youth choir trips every summer, you had to sing a solo in a worship service. Because I really wanted to go that first summer I was involved with the youth group, I signed up to do my part to meet the requirements. To be completely accurate, my very first solo in church was when I was 5 years old. My mom was a really great singer and played the piano, so she was my accompanist. Mom told me that after she started playing the intro, I stopped her to inform everyone that she was playing the song too fast. She said she was a bit surprised, but then started over at a slower tempo. I sang I'm a Millionaire from a Bill Gaither Kids album. No, not about money, but riches in Christ. I was told I did great for a preschooler, but at that age, the cute factor usually overcomes any talent deficits. I hadn't sung in church since I was a little kid, so I was really scared about standing up there in front of everyone. I asked the music minister if I could sing with someone else, and he told me it was fine if I put together a duo or trio. So I recruited two friends who also wanted to go, and we sang a three-part harmony song that was popular at the time called A Simple Prayer, adapted from the prayer of Saint Francis. This experience helped me connect the music I love to my passion for singing. Back then, when a major Christian artist released a song to radio, the record label also produced an accompaniment track on cassette, a recording of the actual song without the lead vocal. Our church allowed us to use those to sing Sunday morning specials. They became the perfect way for me to perform in a professional manner during a service. With the real track, I could sing my favorite songs from my musical heroes and sound just like everyone I heard on the radio. Little did I or anyone in my life know the foundation that God was forming in my heart with Christian music. My two mamas. I was very close to both of my mamas, but Mama Millard, Dad's mom, was around us a whole lot more than Mama Lindsay, especially after Dad and Mom's divorce. Cloris Leachman is a well-respected, iconic Academy Award-winning actress, so when we found out she was open to being in our film, she made sense for the role of my Mama Millard. But first you have to know that Mama Millard was quite a character. She was really funny. She wasn't trying to be, she just was. She was actually a lot like Dad, stoic and direct, but with an incredible sense of humor, though I didn't see that part of my dad until his last few years. She had a wit and wisdom I have never seen equaled in the many people I have met around the world. She was truly one of a kind, and yes, I have more Mama Millard stories to share with you. Stay tuned. After my grandfather divorced her, my dad and his younger brother made it their mission to be sure all of their men stayed out of Mama Millard's life. My dad and his brother sabotaged any efforts men made to try to get close to her, and they succeeded. She never remarried. From my earliest memories, Mama Millard went everywhere with us. She and Dad were almost inseparable. She didn't live with us, but she was always around. She went on every weekend trip and vacation with us. Mom joked that Dad would probably have taken her on the honeymoon if Mom hadn't put her foot down. In recent years, Mom also told me that the reason for this attached-at-the-hip closeness was because my dad felt so guilty. He knew the reason that his mother was alone for the rest of her life was due to his interference in any man trying to bring her happiness. His endearing loyalty was fierce because he felt he had literally ruined her life, and he was trying to make up for something a son can't possibly make up for. This effect that Mama Millard had on Dad was why, even after his accident, no matter how many nurses it would take to control and calm him down, she could just walk in the room and he would submit to her. She always called my dad Bub, so she just used his nickname and told him to calm down, and he would comply. That tiny woman could quiet that huge man with a single sentence. Of course, this caused yet another strain on my parents' marriage. What wife wants her mother-in-law to be around all the time? I have to assume Dad was so strong and insistent that, as in so many other instances, Mom just gave in until she couldn't take anymore. As they say, everyone has their breaking point. Some are just quieter than others until they reach it. My Mama Lindsay, Mom's mother, was an incredible, godly woman and a major part of my life. She prayed constantly, consumed the Bible, and watched Christian TV all the time. I'm certain her countless hours of prayer for me have had much to do with God's grace and favor on my life. After my parents' divorce, and particularly when Mom moved away, both my mamas stepped in and mothered Stephen and me as best they could. In the face of my intense feelings of abandonment from my mom, coupled with Dad's abuse, my grandmothers filled a huge role in my life. They were the calm in my storm. Throughout my childhood, both mamas were such amazing friends. My best guy friend. A lot of my childhood friends were the kids of the parents in the adult singles class at FBC Greenville. One of those friends was Kent, whose mom was in that Sunday school class with my dad. Although Kent was 2 years older than me, we became inseparable. While in so many ways we were total opposites, we had the same interests and sense of humor. Ken is one of those guys who can become good at whatever he decides to do. He was great at sports, and I was decent. He was organized, and I wasn't. He always showed up with a plan, and I was always game to do it. While we were really mischievous and pulled pranks constantly around town, we never drank or got into any kind of serious trouble. Kent and I really connected the week of my first youth camp experience. Our friendship was forged there, and we became very close confidants in each other's lives. He was my only friend who had seen firsthand what my dad was capable of. After witnessing several incidents, Kent was terrified of him and didn't really want to hang out at my house. I didn't blame him. After all, he had a sweet single mom, and that kind of male behavior was foreign in their home. So we were always over at his house. Because his mom knew my dad from church, she would often call and tell him I was going to spend the night over there. He was always good with that. Dad liked Kent for some reason, and he didn't like that many people. This arrangement worked for me. The truth was that Stephen and I didn't want any of our friends to be around all that much in case Dad snapped. One time, a brother and a friend were hanging out in his room listening to music. Dad had told Stephen to take out the trash, but he hadn't. So Dad walked into the bedroom with Stephen's buddy sitting there and dumped out two full bags of garbage in his room. Nasty food leftovers, empty containers with random liquids, everything. Stephen had to clean up the entire mess by himself, rebag it, and take it out. He was humiliated, and that's when he adopted his own no-friends-over policy. For a long time following that incident, Dad would threaten me when he told me to take out the trash, saying, "And if you don't take care of it, I'll come dump it in your room. If you don't believe me, just ask your brother." I never wanted to take the chance to find out for myself, so I always made sure I took care of the garbage when he asked. The desire to stay away from my own home made going to my friends' houses that much more important to me. Kent was the only person in my life whom I'd told everything that happened with my dad. Somehow I was okay with him knowing, because he never judged or looked down on me or made a big deal of it. Kent saw more than anyone else in those toughest years. Walking through that kind of fire with a buddy who knows your business and stands with you forms a unique, unbreakable bond. Kent and I made up two-thirds of what we called the Three Musketeers. We hung out all the time, went to church together, and constantly had a blast. So now it's time to introduce you to the other third of that trio, and the sweetest and prettiest, too. My best girlfriend. Shannon Street's parents were my second-grade Sunday school teachers. That's how far back our relationship goes. In fact, they taught every second grader who came to First Baptist Greenville for 22 years. The story is told that one day after Sunday school, Shannon's mom said to her family, "That Millard boy, I feel sorry for the girl who marries him. He is wild." Shannon and I have gone to church together for as long as either one of us remembers. At that time, FBC had about 300 members, so it was like a big family. There were no cliques, no hierarchy. Everyone got along and did life together. Shannon's family was the opposite of mine. Her dad worked on federal government aircraft for Raytheon. His job was classified as top secret, so he could never talk about what he did from 9 to 5. They had a very conservative, very consistent home life. Their family ate dinner together every night at 5:30 on the dot. For me, they were a ready-made family. Her parents are still happily married, by the way. Shannon is 2 years younger than me, so until she was in junior high, we weren't really on each other's radar that much. But the summer before my freshman year in high school, she came into the youth group as a seventh grader. At Vacation Bible School, she played piano for the younger kids, and I ran the slide projector for the words. I thought she was awesome, and I was crazy about her. She doesn't remember that, but it's true. Shannon's side of the story. Coming into the youth group that summer, I started noticing Bart and thought he was really kind and thoughtful. I was very reserved and quiet, so I was also drawn to his fun and adventurous personality. He always made people laugh and was a good leader. As crazy as it sounds to say now, I was 13 that summer when I looked at him and thought to myself, that's the guy I'm going to marry. Our youth group, led by our incredible youth pastor and dear friend Rusty, went to Glorieta Baptist Camp in New Mexico each year. The first day there, we were given journals and taught how to write down our prayers, sermon notes, spiritual thoughts, dreams, and goals. Starting that first summer, journaling became an important dynamic in my spiritual growth. The first day, I noticed that Shannon was already writing and doodling in her journal. Then at some point, it fell open. It was just lying there, staring up at me, with a message scrawled out in flowery prose as only a young girl can write, "I heart Bart Millard." I stood there, trying to process what I had just seen and what this might mean. I thought, So, this girl likes me too, huh? Well, she hearts me. Cool. Here Shannon and I were, interested in each other and away together for an entire week. One night during free time, we were walking around the camp, away from the rest of the group. We stopped under a very old, large canopy tree. After a few awkward moments, we shared our first kiss together. It was July 1988. Bookmark that detail for later. We went steady that whole summer. Shannon, along with her parents, would come get me in their family car. I had my learner's permit, so I would chauffeur the family around town for the rest of the evening. Her mom would get in the back seat, Shannon would slide next to me in the middle of the front seat, and her dad served as my co-pilot in the shotgun spot. I was joyriding with my girl and her parents. I even drove them on a couple of road trips that summer, one to Shannon's mom's hometown and another to a rodeo. Thanks to her folks, I was good at driving by the time I could get my actual license. I spent a lot of time over at the Street family's home. Shannon and her parents must have thought it was odd that Dad never checked on me, but they never said anything. Her parents treated me like a son, and her mom and I picked on each other a lot. We had a similar sense of humor, and it was great to have that kind of close interaction and camaraderie with a mother, even if she wasn't my own. On our dates, Shannon's dad would drop us off to get pizza or at the movies. There wasn't a lot for kids to do in Greenville back then, so we just hung out a lot, together and with Ken, and talked for hours on the old landline phone when we weren't together. Can you believe we ever used phones that were connected to cords? Shannon's side of the story. Bart always hid what was going on at home with his dad, but everyone I knew was scared of Mr. Millard. One time at church, Bart put his arm around me during the service. His dad, who had been sitting somewhere behind us, saw what happened. He walked up after the service and very seriously, in a strong tone, told Bart to never do that again in church. That terrified me. Later that same summer, the youth choir went on a week-long tour singing at various churches. We all stayed with a family at a huge house in Lake Charles, Louisiana. The girls stayed inside and the guys got to sleep on a large boat docked on the water behind the house. Shannon and I slipped away from everyone, and standing there next to the moonlight water, we had our second kiss. By now, you're probably wondering where all the church chaperones were on these trips, right? Ah, the innocence of those days. When summer was over and I started high school as a freshman, I thought it might not be cool to date a junior high girl, so I broke up with Shannon. Yet we managed to stay friends because that was always the foundation of our relationship. The unwritten teenage social laws have always stated you're supposed to hate each other after breaking up, but we never did. It also helped that our youth group was so close-knit and that our youth pastor was a common bond between us, offering accountability and encouragement. Shannon's side of the story. After that first breakup, I always kept hope alive that things would work out with me and Bart. Plus, I noticed any time we were around each other, he would show off and try to get my attention. This worked out great for me because I always wanted to be where he was, and of course, we were always at church together. By the time Shannon got to high school as a freshman, when I was a junior, our strong friendship had led us back into dating again. We hung out all the time, alone and also with Kent. No matter what was going on with Shannon and me in our relationship, the Three Musketeers managed to stay together. But then, at the beginning of my senior year, the vicious lack of commitment cycle circled back around again. I decided I didn't want to date an underclassman, so I broke up with Shannon for the second time. Do you ladies hate me yet? I admit I was a fickle jerk, okay? Shannon's side of the story. We were driving in the car when he started telling me about wanting to be able to focus on his senior year and date other people. I was heartbroken, but I decided to play it off like I was strong and he wasn't getting to me this time. I said something like, yeah, I've actually been thinking about the same thing. When Bart thought that I was okay with the breakup, he told me that he wanted to play a joke on my mom where he would go up to the door, tell her he broke up with me, and say that I was completely devastated. Still in shock but trying to be brave, I agreed to it. So when we pulled up to the house, Bart played off the joke and then told my mom he was only kidding. He assured her everything was fine. She laughed it off and then he left. After he drove away, I told mom the truth and then fell apart. I was really mad at him and then so was she. That time I thought I was done and I never wanted anything like that to happen to me again, but I was so confused because I really thought Bart was the one. Shannon was my first girlfriend. She set the standard that no one else could measure up to. She was everything to me, and her family was everything my family wasn't. She was so compassionate, with such a gentle spirit. She always cared about me when I felt no one else did, and she was always, always a great listener, which I so needed. I honestly have never known anyone quite like her. I guess that's exactly why I could never find another girl to rival her, even though I tried. Every girl paled in comparison, and nobody could ever make me laugh like she could. No one in my life ever cared about me the way Shannon did. Because my home life made my middle school and high school years even more difficult than the typical teen struggles, I'm so thankful for all the anchors, my two mamas, my youth group, my love of singing and music, Kent, and Shannon and her family that God placed in my life. They all helped me hold fast to Him and find hope when I needed it the most. Little did I know I was about to need that support more than ever. Chapter 4. New Lease on Life. O Lord, have mercy on this weary soul. Come and take me to the river and make me whole. It's down with the old and up with the new. The hard reset, my life, take two. Mercy Me, New Lease on Life. From Welcome to the New, 2014. One night when I was a freshman in high school, Dad was having dinner at his favorite diner in Greenville, the Royal Drive-In, when he started feeling ill. He had severe abdominal pain, and his speech became slurred. He wasn't making sense to the waitress, so she knew something was wrong and called for an ambulance. The emergency room doctor ordered a round of tests to discern a diagnosis. When Dad's lab and blood work results came back, the doctor quickly saw he had very low blood sugar and diagnosed him with diabetes. Believing that was the sole source of the pain, the doctor released him with medications and instructions for managing his newly discovered disease. It's important to note that while Dad was a tall man, by this point in his life, he weighed well in excess of 300 pounds. But his condition didn't get better. In fact, it started getting worse. Mama Millard and I noticed his skin was very yellow. Even his eyes looked yellow. Realizing he was severely jaundiced, he went back to the hospital. As the diabetes treatments appeared not to be working, the doctors feared that something else could be wrong, something much worse. They ran more extensive tests, but were not satisfied with the findings. They informed us that they wanted to perform exploratory surgery. Reluctantly, Dad agreed. About 4 hours into the surgery, a doctor came out and told us Dad had pancreatic cancer. We were in shock. He then said they were trying to find exactly where on his pancreas the cancer was located. If it was on one specific area of the organ, that would indicate he had only months to live. If it was in another spot, he could have several years left. When the doctor returned to the operating room, we sat in the waiting area praying that he didn't have the bad cancer, but the good cancer. After another 4 hours passed, the doctor told us they had found all the cancer on the side they had hoped for, that Dad should have a few more years to live. That was such a surreal moment. On one hand, we were devastated that he had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, but on the other, we were grateful that we had longer than just a few months left with him. As it turned out, there are many more times in this journey that we had to choose between the bad and the worst viewpoints. The day following the surgery, when Dad was fully awake and alert, his doctor delivered the news of what they had found. He told Dad that he had pancreatic cancer, one of the most aggressive and brutal types. He went on to explain that the reason he had contracted diabetes and was jaundiced was because the cancer had spread to his liver. The doctor told Dad that with proper care and treatment, he had at best 7 to 10 years to live. Of course, with cancer, there are no guarantees. Isn't it interesting? We all understand we are going to die. None of us know how long we have. But as soon as a medical professional puts a number to our remaining days, it completely changes our perspectives of both death and life. That was certainly the case with my dad. When he received the cancer diagnosis, Dad was just 44 years old. I was 15. Mama Millard took the news very hard. Her ex-husband, my grandfather, was only in his early 40s when he died of cancer. Even though they had been divorced for quite a while, not by her choice, she still loved him. Now she felt as though her nightmare was happening all over again, as her son had now received the same news in almost exactly the same year of his life. That day, as soon as school was out, I went straight to the hospital. When we talked about the cancer, Dad didn't cry, even though they told me he had after getting the news that morning. I saw and heard a noticeable change in his face and in his voice as he spoke. I saw what could only be described as a humility I had never seen him express. Some might say I had every right to think Dad was receiving some kind of what goes around, comes around, reap what you sow, cosmic justice. They might think I might even be relieved or somehow glad that this was happening to the man who had been such a monster to me in both the violence and the silence for so many years. And it's true that many days I had wished God would take this man out of my life because of the pain he had caused me. But now I was praying he might be saved simply because he was my dad. Reality and repentance. All I could think about was that a doctor had handed my dad a death sentence. Regardless of my painful past, he had been my only available parent since the third grade. For better or for worse, he was still my father. He was this big, strong man's man, and I had believed nothing or no one could ever take him down. Yet I had been told that something was going to do just that. I looked at Dad lying in that hospital bed and thought about what must be running through his mind and heart. I felt horrible for him. Something new was happening inside me. The anger in my heart was moving aside and making room for compassion. Sympathy welled up in me, along with my tears. Rusty, my youth pastor, came to the hospital. We found a quiet spot, and he sat with me while I let the dam break and all my emotions pour out. Any setting where I could open up with Rusty to talk one-on-one always created a safe place for me, one of only a few in my life. I always knew my dad was physically strong, but in the days that followed, a different strength emerged in him. When Dad went to church before, it had been for social reasons. He wanted to be around other singles and have a group to spend time with. Now going to church was completely about the Lord, not the ladies. He also became gentler, more compassionate. The bottom line, somehow my dad was changing for the better. It was as though whatever had happened to his mind years ago when he woke up after the truck accident had started to reverse when he woke up from the exploratory surgery. Years before, something had gone very wrong. Now, through a cancer diagnosis of all things, something was finally going in the right direction for Dad and for me. An old saying goes, the storms of life make you either better or bitter. I guess Dad decided he had had enough of bitter and wanted to try better this time. We have all heard about angry, resentful people who get bad news that sends them even deeper into a chasm of disillusionment and disgust with life. But Dad started climbing out of the pit he had been in for so many years. Or maybe someone was lifting him out and his heart was finally opening. Maybe he hit the proverbial bottom, looked up, and asked God for help. For as long as I could remember, Dad's anger and pride had always gotten the best of him. He could never admit he was wrong. Now the anger began showing up less, the pride took a back seat to a new humility, and he began leaving room for others, including me, to have something to say. I made a decision, even at that young age, that I had to stop being afraid of my dad. I knew I had to step outside of what had been and start to see him as a hurting and suffering human being. I had to care about him in a completely different way. I was forced to grow up really fast when Mom left us. Now I was forced again to go to another level, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. I took on more of a caretaker role in looking out for Dad, and miraculously, that cleared the way for him to be more involved in my life. Our new common enemy of cancer moved us toward each other, to stand back to back and battle the disease together instead of going toe to toe, with me constantly trying to defend myself. Things were changing. When I checked on him at night to turn off his light, I would see his open Bible in his hands. He had fallen asleep reading it. We also started spending more time together. Dad tried to exercise to improve his quality of life, so we walked on the local track, which gave us time to talk. We'd always watch sports, especially football and TV together. Now we also watch comedies. We would laugh together, which we had never done before. I even got to the point of staying home with him instead of going out in the evenings. For the first time in my life, we were choosing to be together. The Pickup Project. Dad owned a 1963 Chevy pickup that had sat in the driveway for years. It was a hunter green short bed step side model with a column shift, three on the tree transmission, and the obligatory gun rack in the back window. Very Texas. For good reason, Dad didn't own a gun, so he kept an umbrella hanging across the arms on the rack. When I was a kid, the truck was drivable but needed work. Dad didn't have the money to fix it up, so eventually the truck wouldn't run. Knowing we were on borrowed time, he wanted to get it back into operation while he was still physically able. He also saw it as an opportunity for us to have a project to do together. But I was still struggling with my conflicted feelings between the past and present, so I wasn't totally on board with the idea. I think Dad wanted to make positive memories with me and maybe leave me with a cool classic truck to drive after he was gone. But I ruined that by not letting go of my pride. The battle came to a head one day when we were standing at the truck and I was refusing to work on it with him. He got angry, picked up the spare tire, and tried to throw it as hard as he could across the driveway. For many years, that feat would not have been hard at all for Dad. But with the cancer now sapping his strength, he was just too weak. As he dropped the tire, he lost his balance and fell down. Frustrated, I walked over and easily picked up the tire with one hand. Dad just laid there, staring up at me, and in desperation said, "Go ahead, son. You know you've always wanted to do it. Take your shot. Here I am. Hit me with it." I paused, turned away, and put the tire back in the truck bed without saying a word. Of course, while I had thought plenty of times about taking some kind of revenge, those days were long over. I wasn't about to physically hurt him now, but I realized my words and attitude were doing plenty of damage, just as his had done to me. I sensed a deep conviction that I had to find the strength to change how I felt. I once heard a pastor say that when it comes to the sins of our fathers, we either repeat or repent. Dad was repenting, and I needed to make my choice too. Dad had always told Stephen and me that if he could ever lose enough weight to meet his goal, he was going to trade in that old truck for a brand new one. Unfortunately, the cancer eventually caused him to hit the goal, but Dad decided that regardless of the reason, he was going to keep his word. So Dad decided that instead of us trying to repair the old one, he would replace the old classic clunker with a newer model. The new truck also had a manual transmission, which I had not yet learned to drive. When Dad had to be in the hospital for several days, I got inside, pulled out onto the access road in front of our house, and ground those gears good until I figured out how to shift and drive it. When he was released from the hospital, I surprised him by driving up in the new truck. Dad smiled the entire way home. He was pleased to see that I taught myself how to drive a manual transmission. The pickup trucks became a metaphor for our relationship. We had to give up the old, broken-down life for a new start to get where we needed to go together. And just as I learned to drive that truck, I was about to be challenged to learn a great deal more. The Great Soup Spoon Heist. Before his diagnosis, Dad would never have been playful in public, pulled any kind of prank, or done anything to make us laugh together. But one memory I have of how much Dad was changing stands out to me. For some reason, he really liked the soup spoons from Royal Drive-In, his favorite eatery, and he could never find any like them in the local stores. The manager wouldn't sell him any either, so he decided he was going to steal as many of them as he could each time he came to eat until he could get an entire set of his own. He would ask the waitress, "Oh, by the way, can I get another soup spoon?" And while she was distracted, he would stick them one by one down into the shafts of his cowboy boots. By the time we were ready to leave, he had several spoons stuffed in them. Every step he took, Dad jingled as though he had on spurs or bells or something. He walked as softly as he could, shuffling out of the diner, but we always laughed for a long time when we got outside. By the time we'd eaten several meals there, Dad always ordering soup, he finally got his coveted, albeit stolen, set of diner soup spoons. Eventually, Dad got worse and was mostly bedridden. Word had gotten around town about his decline, and one evening the owner of the Royal Drive-In came to the house. Dad hadn't been able to eat there in a while, so I thought, uh-oh, they heard about Dad stealing the spoons, and the jig is up. He's so busted. Well, yes and no. The waitresses figured out what Dad was doing, and they thought it was so funny to watch him sneak their soup spoons out in his boots. While I was sitting in the booth with Dad, trying to hide my laughter, the waitresses were evidently in the kitchen laughing, too. Like everyone else, they heard him jingling as he walked out the door. They started putting their scratched and bent spoons in a box labeled for Bub. Knowing they were going to get rid of them anyway, they thought, why not let Arthur get rid of the old spoons for us, since he obviously wants them so badly? Now, appreciating the regular customer Dad had been and knowing that soon he would no longer be well enough to come in, the owner brought him a brand new set of those soup spoons, still in the box. Dad was a little embarrassed but very touched at the same time. That gift was a great example of what the community thought about Bub. The False Alarm Confessional. Following Dad's diagnosis when I was a freshman in high school, the doctor had described the kind of symptoms that would signal to us that the end was near. One night during the first year of his illness, I came home and found him lying on the bathroom floor, throwing up. He was wrapped in a blanket, shaking from severe chills. I hadn't been gone very long, so him being that ill so quickly scared me. As soon as he saw me, he started to cry. "Bart," he said, "you know I love you. I've always loved you. I'm so sorry for not telling you. I wish I hadn't messed up with your mom. Please take care of Mama." He thought that this was the beginning of the end, so he was telling me everything he wanted me to know as fast as he could. Dad continued sharing his heart while we waited for an ambulance. I just listened. Just as he began to say all the things he would miss in Stephen's and my lives after he was gone, the oncoming sound of the sirens interrupted him. I had teared up when he talked about his absence, but the bright lights of the ambulance piercing through the windows as the paramedics pulled up to the house caused me to quickly dry my eyes. After running a gamut of tests, the emergency room doctor announced, "Well, Arthur, these aren't symptoms from cancer. You actually just have the flu." It was a quiet ride home as we both replayed all that Dad had said that night. Thinking he was dying, he had shared with me what he thought were his last words. believing that the end was close had made him become very honest about his life and where he was with those he loved. That night started him on the journey of opening up his heart. After that, Dad made an effort to never miss any event I was involved in at school or church. But he also started going to things he never would have considered attending before, like parent meetings at church. He was sticking to the changes. Unless he was just too weak or sick from his symptoms or the chemo, he was there. Dad was committed. After I got my driver's license, I started leaving the house more, dating, hanging out with friends, and my social life took priority, as happens with most normal teenagers. But of course, my home life had never been normal, and it certainly still wasn't. Through the ups and downs of his disease, I kept seeing signs that God was most certainly at work in Dad. One night when I came in to check on him after he'd fallen asleep, his Bible was lying there, open as always, but this time I noticed he had been writing all kinds of notes in the margins. Throughout the entire Bible were countless scribbled observations and remarks. I couldn't believe it. I didn't realize how much he was not just reading but studying the scriptures. The Apostle Paul speaks of how the Word of God brings about transformation of the mind. In that moment, I realized that God was literally changing Dad's mind. Over time, we started to talk more and more the way a father and son are supposed to. Because his words were now seasoned with God's words, I started getting a sense of responsibility as to who I needed to become spiritually as a Christian. Dad instilled in me that my calling was bigger than just singing. My identity was not in my voice, but in Christ. I was a child of God who sang, not a singer who happened to be a Christian. It would take me years to truly grasp that one. He knew my gift had a higher purpose. Dad said he believed that even his illness was a part of God's plan, and he wanted it to be used for his glory. For a human with terminal cancer to make that statement, something deep and profound has to be going on in the heart and soul, something not of this world. A consistent theme threaded throughout Dad's constant advice was for me to do what he felt he hadn't done. His focus was for me to avoid becoming who Dad had been, but God was taking us both to a new destination, together. Dad had a lot of false alarms as the cancer slowly consumed him. I'd find him unresponsive and call the ambulance once again. He'd go to the hospital, and I'd wonder if this might be it. But then he would bounce back, and sometimes he could even go back to work at the highway department. After the accident, he had gone into the surveying department, mapping out new locations and paths for road construction. By this point, Dad was overseeing a crew from an office and didn't always have to go out on site. Between work, home, and the hospital, Dad was in and out of the house, and so my life was a roller coaster during my high school years. When most of my friends were focused on having fun on the weekend and dreaming of the amazing adventures they would embark upon after their graduation, I was dealing with the emotional battle of Dad's impending death and figuring out what I could do to help with the constant regimen of his treatment. Divine Interruption 1. Let me rewind for a bit to introduce a new plot twist that happened during my sophomore year. An event lasting only a few seconds affected the rest of my high school days in a major way and actually influenced the direction of the rest of my life. After playing football for years in city leagues, I put everything I had into playing high school ball. That's what Dad had always wanted. His passion for the pigskin caused me to be consumed with it to try to please him. Even though things between us were beginning to go much better, old habits and human patterns don't die easily. As I took my position on the line of scrimmage, knowing a pass play had been called and I might get the ball, I remember my dad's voice taunting me. "I don't go down when they hit me, but you, Bart, you go down too easy. That's your problem." The maddening thing about verbal abuse is how the words you've heard replay in your head hundreds of times, even when the person is not around or stops saying those things to you. Like the tapes playing in my Walkman, Dad's criticisms and cutdowns were on repeat. But the difference was I never chose to push play. Instead, those hurtful words just randomly sounded off at the worst possible times. They were a lousy motivator, but they drove me to go all out and take risks to make a play. My end goal was not just pleasing, but impressing Dad. I'd started out as a lineman, but I switched to tight end at the beginning of 10th grade and was just 2 months in at my new position. During a pregame scrimmage, we were running plays, offense against defense, when a pass play was called. The center snapped the ball, and I fired off the line running full speed. I ran my pattern, made my cut, and turned. There was the ball, thrown like a rocket by the quarterback, but it was high. I jumped straight up as far as possible to make sure I could make the catch. While I hung in midair, two linebackers ran into me, one from each side, and hit helmet to helmet, with both my feet sandwiched in between. I felt the force of the collision, and then a horrible sting ran all the way up my body. The bones in both ankles were immediately broken. I fell to the ground in excruciating pain. I quickly realized Whatever had happened was not going to be a shake it off and get back in the game thing. The coaches took one look at my feet and called an ambulance. After the doctors reviewed the x-rays, they told me my ankles were shot. While they would heal, I could never risk more injury by playing football again. That is, if I wanted to be able to keep walking for the rest of my life. So with the sudden surprise of the elimination of sports from my schedule, I begrudgingly joined the school choir for my elective replacement. My singing voice hadn't changed when I hit puberty, and I could still hit the same high notes I had as a child. For an adult professional singer, that's awesome. But when you're a teenager having to sing around your peers, not so much. I'd learned to save singing for church. Now that a wheelchair and then crutches were a part of my life, I found myself trying to anonymously and visibly blend in with the choir kids. Ew. Isn't it interesting how some life-changing devastations are actually like the crossover switches on train tracks that take you in a totally new direction, often forcing you onto the path you were supposed to be on all along? God had certainly brought a divine interruption into my life, taking me out of sports and putting me into choir. But then my life took yet another unexpected twist. Divine Interruption 2. A friend of mine who wanted to audition for the school's show choir really wanted to sing the Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder hit song Ebony and Ivory, a duet requiring a male who had a high voice. So to help him out, I auditioned with him and sang Stevie's part. When Miss Fincher, the choir and show choir director, heard me sing by myself for the first time, she was completely surprised, pleasantly surprised. She pulled me aside and told me she was putting me in the show choir. Whoa, wait. I was just helping my buddy out. I had no intention of this being my audition, too. No, I can't do this, I protested. What are you trying to do to me? I only got into choir in the first place to get my required credits. I'm not an overachiever trying to do extracurricular stuff. She just glared at me and said, you can and you will, and there will be no further discussion about it. Not believing what was happening, I went at her again. No, you don't understand. I am a Millard. Millards play sports. Millards do not sing and act. She was unshaken. You have a gift, Bart, a gift, and in my class you will be required to use it or fail. It's your choice. Running out of arguments, I tried another tactic. I don't sing that Broadway stuff, and I certainly can't act. I'll teach you. I was growing desperate. I decided to flatter her. Look, you are a nice person, a really good person. I like you. I respect you. But there is no way, no way at all you will ever get me onto that stage. She turned, looked over her glasses at me, and glared. She wasn't mean, just really serious with that give up because you will not change my mind look. Actually, it was a lot like when one of my mamas would let me know when negotiations were officially over. It was too late. Miss Fincher had heard me and made up her mind. I was, by golly, now in the show choir, like it or not. I owe her a great debt for sticking to her guns to force me to overcome my fear and step out of my comfort zone to sing a solo on stage in front of a packed house of peers and parents. Foreshadowing, you think? I guess you could also say that was the moment someone discovered something about me I didn't even know. It's one thing to believe in yourself, but when others around you start to join in and encourage you, it's a totally different dynamic. Soloing in the Sanctuary. I was a latchkey kid, coming home to an empty house after school until Dad got home from work. So I often rode the bus to the stop closest to the church, went into the worship center, and sang along with my favorite Christian artists. Church sanctuaries all over the United States sit empty most of the week. I took advantage of this at our church, using the worship center for my vocal studio for a couple of hours every weekday. I would sing and sing and sing. I had no idea at the time I was rehearsing for my career. The church had a giant cassette tape deck, like my Walkman on steroids. I would fire up the soundboard and turn on the amps. One day I saw a set of super nice over-the-ear headphones plugged into the tape deck and put them on. I reached into my bag and pulled out the latest and greatest cassette from Stephen Curtis Chapman, a CCM legend, popped it in, and hit play. The next sound I heard through the phones was Stephen's His Strength is Perfect, which was such a powerful message for me at that point in my life. I was immersed, overwhelmed. The sound was incredible. The words went deep. As the verse began, I started to sing along loudly. You know how people can't hear how ear-splittingly loud they're singing when they have headphones on? But I was in an empty auditorium, or so I thought. Unbeknownst to me, Doug, our new music and youth pastor, who had no idea I could sing, had walked into the sanctuary. I was paying zero attention, lost as always in the music, still singing at the top of my lungs. He heard the music still blaring through the stage speakers, so he walked over and shut down the power to the system. But because I had on the headphones with the song still playing, I didn't realize that now all anyone could hear was my voice. Doug heard me belt out, "His strength is perfect when our strength is gone. He'll carry us when we can't carry on. Raised in his power, the weak become strong. His strength is perfect." By this time, everyone knew about my dad's illness and how I was helping with his care, so the power of the message I was singing wasn't lost on him. So now the new worship pastor knew I could sing too. At school and at church, singing was becoming my thing, totally by accident. A Millard and a musical? Each year, Mrs. Fincher and the drama teacher teamed up to produce a full-scale musical production, casting the roles according to the acting and singing skills. True to her word, Mrs. Fincher announced they were putting me in as an extra and Fiddler on the Roof. While I wasn't thrilled with the idea, I figured I could just blend in and sing with the chorus. But after that musical's run was over, she threatened me with the lead in The Offering of Oklahoma, planned for my junior year. I wasn't at all ready for the idea and just brushed her off. I didn't even audition for a role. I forgot all about what she had told me until the casting list was made public at school. A friend walked by me and said, "Hey, Bart, congratulations." Another passed me and said, "Way to go, Millard." I had absolutely no idea what they were talking about. Just then, Shannon came running around the corner, grabbed me, and said, "Congratulations." "What?" I asked. "You haven't heard yet? I have to say I'm a bit jealous." No one was more confused than I was. I asked again, "What are you talking about?" She told me to go look at the bulletin board where the director had posted the casting sheet for the musical. We headed toward the board, and sure enough, there at the top of the list, I saw my name as the male lead, Bart Millard as Curly. Shannon put her arm on my shoulder, grinned ear to ear, and asked, "So, how excited are you?" At that moment, I was terrified, in complete and total disbelief. They had done it. My teachers had conspired together to cast me as the lead to sing and to act, just as they had said they would the year before. I'll never forget the moment I stepped out for the first time in full cowboy costume to sing, "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning" from Oklahoma. While it felt strange, it was also oddly comforting. Dad, Mama Millard, Shannon, and Kent were in the audience, middle center. Dad was glad I found something I could connect with since sports were taken away. He was proud of what I was accomplishing on stage. Shannon said that when I started to belt the first song, Mama leaned over to her and said, "Mercy me, that can't be his real voice." Shannon assured her it was, but I think everyone was quite surprised that night. While they all knew I could sing, my acting put my performance on a totally different scale. When my first song was over, I was completely caught off guard by the audience's response. It was kind of like the first time I held Shannon's hand. It felt right and peaceful, like when you open a gift and realize it'll be an important part of your life for a very long time. My senior year, the teachers decided to put me on The Music Man. They offered me the male lead again, but because I had a reputation as an unemployed comedian, I wanted to play Mayor George Shinn, the pompous but playful governing official of River City. I closed out my high school choir and acting career as the comic relief. Mrs. Fincher was the first person to convince me that I had a gift that not only had to be open, but also needed to be shared. She was an amazing encouragement and inspiration to me. But professional singer wasn't a popular career choice in Greenville, Texas. So no one, at least at that point in my life, thought I would take my newly discovered talent past high school. Regardless, there was a new truth I had to come to accept about myself. In spite of all the fears and flaws I'd been reminded of my entire life, I can sing. Life lessons from my movie dad. If you have been even a casual movie watcher over the years, chances are you've seen a film starring Dennis Quaid. Since his career began in the mid-1970s, he has appeared in every genre from family films to sci-fis and rom-coms to westerns. Dennis played my dad in the film version of my story. One of the first days of shooting, Dennis pulled me aside and said, "Bart, I really want to make you proud. I want to make your dad proud. I want to represent Arthur well, but I don't have him to talk to, so you're my guy. You need to tell me what I need to know to get this right." In scene after scene, we talked about how he would interpret my dad to the camera. Often, as soon as the director said cut after a difficult scene, Dennis would look straight over at me to see if I was okay after watching something so emotionally draining and to see what I thought about his performance. Watching Dennis portray my father was like working with a counselor, helping me process struggles and emotions from my past. In one particularly difficult scene, after J. Michael Finley, the actor who played me, walked out the door of the film set, I turned to watch Dennis. To my surprise, as the camera continued to roll, I began to see what Dad might have felt after I had left the room and he was alone. Witnessing the struggle and regret on the actor's face brought me to tears. I never thought, how did Dad feel after something happened between us? Seeing that was so hard but oddly healing at the same time. I began to consider what Dad might have gone through in those private moments, the grief and anguish he might have experienced from both feeling and inflicting so much pain. In a strange way, I felt compassion for my dad even while watching scenes depicting the abuse. Being on the movie set was certainly a cathartic experience, and it brought up new emotions in me. They say that hurt people hurt people, and for the first time, that truth really connected. I felt sorry for my dad and what he had gone through. Dennis also encouraged me that there are some things the movie could not depict, and I needed to hold them in my heart, just for me. He did an incredible job of portraying my father throughout the entire film, and his heart to me was so gracious. And yes, I am certain that Dad would have been proud and honored by Dennis's performance. Chapter 5. In the Blink of an Eye. You put me here for a reason. You have a mission for me. You knew my name and you called it, long before I learned to breathe. Mercy Me, In the Blink of an Eye. From Undone, 2004. While I was not certain about the exact moment Dad came to Christ, it was becoming very clear to me that he had definitely embraced the gospel. He wasn't very outspoken about his faith, but I saw the transformation in him in our home, behind closed doors. The man he was in private was now the same man he was in public. He was no longer the man I had grown up with, but just as no one really knew how bad my dad was before, now no one could really appreciate how godly he had become after giving his life to Christ. One of the inspiring dynamics we see throughout the Gospels is how consistent and balanced Jesus was, being the same person to everyone he met. I saw that same quality become real in my dad. Often I could hear him praying for my brother and me behind his closed bedroom door. Sometimes I would hear him weeping over the loss of my mom through their divorce. To go from anticipating a shouting match or a whipping to hearing the faint whispers of him praying for me was a personal trip from hell to heaven on earth. While month by month there was consistently less of Dad and more of Jesus, the cancer caused his weight to drop from around 350 pounds down into the 100s. When Mom found out that Dad was sick, she started showing up a lot, trying to take care of the three of us. Steve and I resented her because we felt that it was too little too late. But Dad and Mom started to talk a lot. Each expressed regret about their past and offered forgiveness to the other. I'm sure that time was hard but good for them both to have the opportunity to wipe away the anger and grief, to get out all that had been between them for all those years. Later, Mom told me that one night they had started talking about their lives as our parents. They shared all the great qualities they saw in Stephen and me and how no matter how hard they worked to mess us up, we actually turned out to be fine young men. After all the years of dysfunction, it was nice to hear that they had such a positive and healthy discussion about how we turned out. There was one complication to Mom's involvement in our lives. Jerry, Dad's longtime girlfriend, was at our house a lot, and we were obviously very close to her. In fact, Steve and I agreed that Dad should have married her years before, though he said he did not want to saddle her down with his illness and become her burden. The entire situation was strange to me, as so often both women were there, but Mom would be the one to wash Dad's hair and perform other intimate caretaking responsibilities. They all seemed to navigate it well and allow for each other's places, so I never said anything. But I also noticed Jerry often taking the high road and backing off or leaving to respect Mom. Jerry showed true love and grace. That's the kind of woman she was and why we all loved her. Dad's relationship with Jerry had grown to be much like the one he had with Mama Millard. She, too, could handle Dad. Jerry was good for him, and he was always in a better mood and frame of mind when she was around. She loved the Lord, was always looking out for Stephen and me, and encouraged Dad constantly in his relationship with us. The war is over. During my senior year, I started dating a girl Dad didn't like. He always preferred Shannon to anyone else. This young lady was a Christian, and Dad had no moral disagreement with her, but there were two glaring issues. First, Dad didn't agree with how I was isolating myself from my youth group and becoming completely focused on her, and second, he just didn't think she was right for me. As a parent myself now, I get how important that latter discernment is. To be honest, I'd become this girl's pet. I would do anything for her. I think Dad saw how I was acting and knew it wasn't good for me. One day we got into an argument about her. We both got heated as the situation escalated. By now, I was essentially a full-grown man, and he was much smaller. Dad's anger got the best of him, and he snapped. He grabbed a dinner plate and from behind smashed it over my head. Pieces of china scattered all over the floor as my head started bleeding. I was shocked. This kind of thing hadn't happened in so long, but his rage immediately sucked me right back into every childhood memory of hurt and rejection. I screamed, "I hate you. I'm done. I'm out of here, and I'm not coming back." I grabbed my keys and stormed out, slamming the door behind me. As I sped away, I had every intention of never returning. If that version of Dad was back, I wasn't sticking around to see it, living or dying. I was not returning to those old patterns ever again now that I was old enough to do something about it. Finally, this time, I did have a choice. Just as I had always done when something bad happened between Dad and me, I went to Kent's house, even though he was away at college. And just as she had always done, his mom listened to me. After tending to my bleeding head, she called Dad to tell him I was there and not to worry. She recommended he give me some time to settle down. I stayed at Kent's house for 4 or 5 days. Being with Kent's mother, one of my surrogate moms, was always comforting to me when these situations made me feel so insecure and alone. As Dad and I cooled down, I thought about his battle with cancer and the limited time we had together. I finally swallowed my pride and came back home. We talked it out and apologized. But what was different this time was that we worked together towards a resolution. We never had another issue after that, not one. We lived in peace. I think we both knew there was no outside problem worth our time and energy. Dad was quickly losing his war with cancer. No disagreement was worth our relationship, especially now. So what about the relationship with the girl? Well, I should have listened to Dad. She ended up breaking my heart right before graduation. In fact, I decided to not even go to the senior party. I think I was the only one not there. Dad was right all along. Something about that plate-breaking incident and its aftermath opened yet another new chapter for Dad. From the moment I came back home, he treated me as an adult and gave me a lot of respect. And something about us working through what happened took away the remaining fears I had still been holding on to. Confessions, coaching, and counsel. Dad had asked his doctor how he would die from this disease. Also a family friend, the doctor was a straight shooter. Typically, he said, the lungs fill up with fluid and the patient slowly drowns. From the get-go, Dad made it clear he did not want to die in a hospital. He was diagnosed with cancer when I was a freshman in high school and started chemo during my junior year. By the beginning of my senior year, as his symptoms got worse, we had moved out most of his furniture and set up a makeshift hospital room in his bedroom. After chemo treatments or emergency care, he would return home to his own private recovery room with all the equipment he needed. During the last year, hospice nurses came to the house. The mother of one of my childhood best friends was a nurse, and Dad was comfortable around her, so she agreed to help during the day shift. His night shift nurse was a guy he became close friends with, and Dad was devastated when the man was killed in a car accident. Dad said he couldn't go through anything like that again, so he wanted to stop the nighttime care and just have our friend come during the day. In his emotional state, he couldn't take having to get to know and trust someone else. During that transition, we also decided that Mama Millard would move in to help take care of us both. It would also be good for her and Dad to be together in this final season because they had been so close for so long. The nurse showed me how to give Dad his medications through his IV during the night. I'm sure this was against policy, but we were trying to accommodate his wishes to the best of our ability. One of the shots had to be given somewhere between midnight and 4 in the morning. And it took at least 2 hours to work through the IV, so Dad and I started having impromptu middle-of-the-night conversations. In some ways, it was as though we had just met and were getting to know each other for the first time, at ages 18 and 48. He asked me questions about my life to get me to start talking. At first, I didn't want to communicate much, but Dad was a captive audience and hung on my every word. He saw this time as a gift from God to make up for the lost years, but I wasn't ready to give in and get too close. Early on in this arrangement, I had to put Dad's care first over my own life, and this contributed to lingering feelings of resentment toward him. Because I was now essentially serving as the night shift nurse, I either couldn't go out on Friday nights or had to be back home in time to administer the meds. But in classic Millard fashion, he kept chiseling away at me. Eventually, I would sit down and download my entire day with him and talk over any problems or frustrations I had. As time went on, I saw the value of getting his wisdom and counsel. A new healing was taking place. I started looking forward to those late-night sessions. I even began to skip going out at all on weekends and would just stay home so we could hang out. I still have the journal where I wrote the words, "I had the first real conversation ever with my dad tonight." Dad had immersed himself deeply in Scripture and learned so much in his walk with God, and he shared much of his newfound knowledge with me. He became my personal pastor, teaching me from an amazing mixture of life experience and biblical wisdom. All that I learned from him in those last 18 months laid the foundation